Good afternoon and welcome to the Eco News Report, a production of the North Coast Environmental Center in conjunction with KHSU, located on the campus of Humboldt State University. I am Raina Nanayel, your host for the Eco News Report. I am Executive Director of the North Coast Environmental Center, and we are really excited today to have Nate Downey, author of Harvest the Rain, with us. He'll be speaking to us about issues related to permaculture and water storage, water harvesting, and water farming. Thank you, Nate, so much for being with us today. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you became involved in rain farming and a little bit about how you decided to head on the journey to write your book, Harvest the Rain?
Well, thank you so much, Rain, for having me on the show today. And, 20 years ago, I took a class with Bill Mollison, and he taught me permaculture. And this was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I lived. And there were some other teachers involved in that group, and I got a job with one of the teachers who was doing permaculture landscaping for clients in the Santa Fe area. And by the end of that year, he didn't really want to be an entrepreneur with employees and that kind of thing, and asked me if I wanted to basically take over his jobs that he had going. And I did, and I made money, and I started my own company. And out there in the Southwest, water is, you know, the critical issue. And it's really the critical issue anywhere, but it's especially critical out in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And from there, I started Santa Fe Permaculture, which focused on edible landscaping and water harvesting and erosion control, as we also focused on how to make that whole thing beautiful for people, too. That's something that's very important to us as a company, that we do think that, and if we're going to bring mainstream America into the sort of the water harvesting revolution, into the permaculture revolution, we are going to have to make some attempts, at least, to make it shine on an aesthetic level as well.
One of the things that's important that you address, what are the major uses of water? So getting our cultures to start thinking about what are we doing with water?
Right. And so with rainwater, you can put it to great use in terms of drinking. It's a very clean resource. The systems that are used to make sure that it's clean, to make sure that all the bird poop and leaves and such are not being drunken, are very surprisingly inexpensive. For about $500, you can get the components to make a very high quality drinking water from your roof. In addition, there's obviously uses back in the home where you can take your roof water and put it back into a toilet for toilet flushing, or with some filtration to go into the showers or the washing machine, depending on where you want to use it.
Uh-huh.
Most people use harvested rain in their gardens, so for their vegetables or for their other plants. That's what I'm most interested in as a permaculturalist. And so there are four forms of rainwater harvesting. The first is passive water harvesting, where you store water in the soil. The next is active water harvesting, where you store water in a tank that's typically pumped out, or if you have a nice amount of gravity below your tank, you can simply use hydraulic lift there to have an active system. The third form of water harvesting is wastewater harvesting, and there's actually two forms of that, gray water and black water. I work mostly with gray water, which is everything but the kitchen sink and the dishwasher and the toilets. So it's everything but that stuff. So it's the shower, the washing machine, the bathroom sinks, and those types of resources are currently just being ignored, and they can be run out to the garden pretty easily and even go to certain edible plants as well. And the fourth form is community water harvesting, which is in a way what we're doing right now. We're educating this community as to the importance of water in our watershed. And so those are the four forms of water harvesting.
Can you just give us a background on permaculture? What is the word mean? How does it work? What do we do?
Yes, actually, it's a contraction of a couple of words, three words, permanent, culture, and agriculture. And it's a synonym for the word sustainability. But sustainability has been co-opted, and actually both words were coined back in 1972. Bill Mollison and David Holmgren coined permaculture in Australia. An economist from Princeton coined sustainability. So it always had a very economic context, whereas permaculture provides a method, if you will, to get us to sustainability on every level, not just the economic level, but the level of food and energy production. And that's where it starts with. That's the method that permaculture said. Here are some principles. Here are some patterns in nature that if you mimic, put to use on your property, you can create or generate your own food and energy on a local level. And that's what permaculture's goal is to produce local food and local energy. And it does use nature as a philosophical and practical means to get to that goal.
Give us a sense of how important groundwater recharge is and what part soils play in that process in relation to the principles of permaculture.
Well, soil is a great filter. So every time you direct water to a passive water harvesting structure, some of that water seeps below where your roots can get it. And very often that means that it's going down to the aquifer, or later, generations from now, someone will be able to use that water. So the groundwater recharge varies from locale to locale. And I understand that even here, where you get so much moisture, there are groundwater issues associated with farming and saltification of the aquifers and just simply usage. So wherever you can recharge your groundwater, you'll be sometimes helping your own generation, but certainly generations to come. And the idea of rainwater harvesting is not necessarily to cut off your groundwater or your surface water source. It's to have an alternative. And when those sources start to run dry, that alternative can be very, very important. Or if it's not an emergency situation, the alternative helps relieve the sort of standard systems that we use to get our water. And by relieving that, there's more for everyone.
It also helps people to get kind of connected to that resource and implies a kind of connection to the soil, because soil is the most effective means of holding water or water storage, or at least one of them.
Oh, yes, it is the place to store water. It's the least expensive place, and really it's the most efficient if you've got some roots there to feed with that water and then to feed yourself, so that if you're closing that loop of importing food from elsewhere, you are helping the environment on so many very essential levels.
And you, in your book and in general as a landscape designer, permaculture designer, you have many recommendations for people in terms of mulch and types of mulch, living mulches. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes, mulch has many functions. And in some cases, I know you do have to worry because it can also function as a harbor for slug. So it might be that you want to change your material, or you might need to reduce some mulch in some cases. But when you have a long dry season, as you do here, I would assume that using various forms of mulching would be very beneficial. And it not only stores water in the soil, it not only prevents erosion from wind and erosion from a slope, it insulates the soil. So on very hot days, the soil itself won't get too hot. And on colder days, it'll not get too cold. And again, it also brings nutrients into the soil. Some of my favorite materials for mulch back in Santa Fe are straw, bark, cardboard, manure, and straw is a type of mulching called sheet mulching, which also acts as an effective weed barrier. So I imagine in places where you've had some pernicious weed problems, it would be a good way of feeding your soil and building your soil as you also prevent weeds. And just briefly, a sheet mulch is a layer of cardboard, a layer of fresh manure, and then a layer of straw or something brown like leaves on top of that. And the reason I say brown is that's going to have more carbon. And the reason I say fresh manure is that's going to have more nitrogen. And that's the building blocks of soil. The reason I say cardboard is that worms love the glue of cardboard, and mycelium, which, and this is not correct to say, but I say it anyway because it makes the most sense, is that the roots of mushrooms, the mycelium. And again, I've been told that's not right to say.
But visually it
yes.
works.
They go through the matrix that is left in the spaces in the corrugation of cardboard, and they can really spread moisture and nutrients throughout your soil very effectively. Yeah, it's cool.
That's really cool. What was the most surprising and inspiring thing you learned about permaculture and just about rainwater harvest? I mean, what really was the trigger that jazzed you up, just on a personal note?
Well, yes. When I first heard about permaculture, I thought it was something more complex than it is. And I think on the first day of my class, when someone said permaculture is nothing new, it's basically my job to get you to use that part of the brain that already knows this.
Right.
So that was very empowering to me. And that's what I do in my talks as well, as I talk about these patterns in nature that we use in permaculture, like branches and spirals and concentric rings and the layers that I just spoke about with the sheet mulch. And it's very, very simple stuff, but it's also connected to some really heavy math too. And it's also connected to a pretty deep philosophical side as well. If you start looking at these patterns that move energy and that move water and that store energy and that store water, you often find that as you look at one pattern, say the tree branching pattern, you often realize that all the other patterns are there at the same time. You just have to change your perspective in time and space. So yes, there's that branching to the tree, but if you lie down on the surface of the soil and look up, you'll see that the branches actually make a spiral. And if you coppice a branch of that tree, you'll see those concentric rings. And if you look down at the roots of the soil, you'll realize that they are participating in this whole layering concept, which is another of these permaculture principles. The web is another very important principle in nature where you're holding some stuff back, but not everything. You're letting nature go through. You're getting typically wind in the case of a web, or water in the case of, say, a web-like beaver dam or a check dam. Mm-hmm. You want to hold back a little bit of the water, but what you're mostly holding back is nutrients and seeds. And every time it rains, you hold back some of the water, but you don't try to make some huge dam and make a pond that, well, you can in some cases, and ponds are fine, but in localized passive water harvesting, it's more about getting that water into the soil. And if you have it in a pond, that'll drown whatever you're trying to grow.
So does permaculture then, in terms of its application, move away from the pipeline, the irrigation canal, to something where you are mimicking a branch-like pattern that then also has a three-dimensional spatial aspect, like perhaps a spiral underneath each branch?
Oh, yes.
Things of that nature, just to give people a sense of how it might look on the landscape.
Well, yes, we move away from sort of the piping, the big ag kind of piping, but we use a lot of pipes as well. How it looks on the land very often in a, say, that I would envision in a perfect permaculture in Arcata, which I just got here today, so you got to take this with a grain of salt. I would envision a tank off the side of a roof that has gravity feeding down to some perennial plants that you want to eat in the summer that might be a little bit exotic and might not be among that list of plants that has adapted here for survival, but those that you want to eat for food. And I say perennial, but it could be annual as well. The permaculture community always looks to perennials first because there's less work involved. You don't have to replant them and they can fight off their own weeds sometimes and that kind of thing. And so annuals are fine as well. But in the perfect place, I would visualize that going to, say, a guild of perennial plants. And I don't know what kind of fruit trees you have here, but in New Mexico, we work with apple trees quite a bit. And we have guilds where every element in the system is performing more than one function and helping the guild, the companion of plants, essentially, become more productive. And so underneath that apple tree or whatever fruit tree, you'd have a living mulch. You'd have, say, some comfrey or some rhubarb, which would help fight off the grasses and shade the soil in the summer so that it doesn't have to work so hard to keep those roots going. You'd also have some nitrogen fixers. Those can often be annuals, legumes like beans and peas. But in New Mexico, we have nitrogen-fixing locusts and other shrubs that do very well to build the nitrogen in the soil. Then you also want to attract pollinators to your fruit tree to make sure that they bear fruit. And you also want to attract other beneficial insect-attracting plants like the umbelliferae, the dill and the fennel, and carrots when they go to seed have this umbelliferous, I think it might be called, quality where you bring in ladybugs and they'll eat the aphids. And so, again, every element in the system should perform more than one function, so that dill is also edible. That comfrey is also can be used as a salve. Sometimes some of the bushes bring in, you know, birds as well as the nitrogen. So
I'm speaking with Nate Downey, author of Harvest the Rain. So this brings me to another impression that I had when I was reading your book, and that is that this is a way of life. This is more than just gardening. This is more than just harvesting water. When I read your book, Harvest the Rain, I get the sense that there's a real transformation of a way of life that has to accompany the process of permaculture and also rain harvest or rain farming. For you personally, was that a journey you went on, or have you seen it with other people at least who are embracing?
Yes, it's for many people who take a permaculture class, it's a life-changing experience for them, and it was for me too. What was good for me was that I had done a lot of political work, political organizing work as a youngster. And I got discouraged, of course.
Been there.
And I'm still very active politically, but I think the reason really is that I discovered permaculture. Because permaculture at first told me, you don't need politics. You can just grow your own food in your own backyard and, you know, just forget society and that kind of thing. And I tried to do that, and I realized, at least where I was, there were certain restrictions that governments imposed. And there may be fewer of those restrictions out here in the sticks, but we weren't actually allowed to use our gray water legally. And we weren't actually allowed to have chickens in the city. And I wasn't able to have a bike lane going down my street. And now all that's possible because some of the political work that I and a bunch of people did in Santa Fe. And so it was funny how it first drew me to it because it was so apolitical. And then it drew me back into politics because it's true that you can do permaculture and maybe be separate from everybody else. But in many places, you still have to integrate with the community on a level that is acceptable to that community. And so that brought me back into politics to try to change those communities for the better, too.
I wanted to ask you if you thought that there is an essential turning away from the trappings of modern society that needs to happen in order to embrace permaculture. Rain farming. And I think you get what I'm saying.
Yes. No. I don't think there's an essential turning away so much. I mean, we have, technology, and we want to use technology in a better way. That's for sure. But I don't think that you have to turn away technology. Yes, just use it in more natural ways.
I was just wondering, in terms of consumerism and its relationship to permaculture, or the messages that we get in our society in terms of making it a holistic change from a renter's perspective.
Yes.
From people who are not landowners, who do not have lavish and vast gardens. How, for them, do we get them involved in something like soil building or rain harvesting? Or maybe there's a kind of philosophical first step that permaculture can give them, where it's a turning away from aspects of the society that are not sustainable or not permaculture based.
Yeah, I think the first step would be make it fun. Okay. And that's something that's a community can really do. If community gardens, I was just up in Portland, I was just up in Eugene, and I'm sure you have them here. The community gardens that you have in these places, I think, are an incredibly powerful movement. And so for people who are renters, people who don't, for whatever reason, don't have a place to garden in an apartment, if you can get connected with some of your friends, it could be a lot more fun than just doing it in your own backyard with your own screaming kids and your own screaming wife, right? I mean, you know, why not watch other people scream at each other?
And tend their soil.
And just get down there with some friends and learn from each other. And I'm sure a lot of these community gardens have fall festivals and that kind of thing. And so making it fun, making it healthy, making it pay back something. Now, water harvesting and storing water, say, in a tank is expensive. And the payback on that isn't always so clear economically, unless you're looking really long term and you're going to sell that piece of property and it's much more valuable 30 years later because you've done all this water harvesting, something like that. But the payback on passive water harvesting is quick, and it can be, you know, the course of a summer, suddenly you've got a strawberry and wow. And just by digging a little ditch off the downspout from your house, you've got a sweeter strawberry than you could get from sort of the grocer.
At that point, what we're talking about is really taking some pride in your soil and then channeling the runoff from your structure in a way that gets the water to the entire system around your house that's living, which would be the soil plant biome, in a way that makes sense for the soil and the plant.
So, yeah. And conceptually, just so people know how to do that, is to think of that source, that downspout from the roof. And this is what you want to do throughout your property. Find all the sources of water, because it might not just be the downspout. In your case, it might be a driveway. It might be a neighbor's roof. It might be a pathway, a patio, a deck. It could be the gray water system. But whatever you have that source, you want it to take as long as possible to leave your property. So you picture just a grid with sort of a zigzag going diagonally from one corner to the other, and just try to make it go like taking a slow circuitous route. One way to do that is with swales that are dug along the contour of a slope, with the dirt from the ditch that makes a swale placed on the downhill side in the form of a berm, so that after a rainstorm you have a temporary pond that soaks in and gets associated with all that soil that has all that edge. And so rather than going through the engineering of a large pond kind of reservoir that, again, won't have so much edge, which will lose water to evaporation in the summer and will not make as much contact with the soil. Better to have a series of these on-contour swales that gradually, they're going along the contour of the slope, so they're basically parallel to sea level, and that's easy to determine that line in your property. And once you have that fill up, then it goes into the next one below. And when that fills up, that passes water to the next one below that. And gradually you can zigzag your water across your property very, very slowly. That's so, and what Mollison says is every drop of water to leave our property is a failure in our system. And so that's a little bit extreme, I think, in a rainforest like this. You don't have to be hard on yourself, but it's a good goal to keep in mind.
And it's also reminiscent. You know, we're talking in some ways about topography, and all of us have seen these neighbors that put us to shame who have these beautifully topographic landscapes that they've designed with the most amazing native plants. And the plants seem to do better because it's not a flat garden. There's topography in the landscape that they've designed.
That's right. You have little niches and what we call microclimates.
Exactly. And so it's a kind of win-win, you know, creating that topography. What you're saying is that there's also a way to sort of design that topography so that the water that is naturally going to run off or follow gravity doesn't leave your property and turn into runoff that then pollutes streams and rivers and doesn't reabsorb or recharge groundwater. It's not just creating any old topography, but there's a kind of there's a design.
It's, yes, thinking your property as a potential sponge, and so you're making pores for the water to soak in. Another important benefit is that as you do that, you won't have erosion. So that can be very important along driveways and your house foundations, and just if you're wanting to think of your property over the long haul and you don't want it to sort of end up in the Pacific Ocean.
From talking with people about these issues here and there, I do know that one of the most frustrating things for people in California is where do we buy rain harvest supplies, materials? How do we design rain harvest equipment? Where are we getting this kind of thing? And I know that Australia is a leader in some of this. Europe is a leader. And so it's a little bit frustrating for people who can't just run out to a store or run out to the hardware store, particularly if they're not builders or engineers.
You are absolutely right about Australia being a leader, and parts of Europe, Germany in particular, have been leading the rainwater harvesting revolution. However, at this point, I was just up at a conference, I think it was the 8th annual American Rainwater Catchment Systems Association conference. Yeah, it was like, I was kind of the token permaculture. There's a couple of great permaculture people who are affiliated with that group, and just a lot of, you know, contractors with their collared shirts and very, very fun group of guys. But anyway, there's more and more contractors out there learning about this. And it was a rather large conference, and there's stacks of materials that I've brought back from. And just basically, there's a lot of stuff, actually, from at least Portland and, you know, San Francisco and Los Angeles. But the biggest cost challenge you would have here, one of the biggest, is the shipping costs. But there are some tanks that don't ship for very much. Some systems fit within themselves or collapse in on themselves and can be shipped very inexpensively. There are these milk crate systems that they look like milk crates when you open them up, but they flatten out. And so you can stack a whole cistern on a pallet. And what ends up happening with that milk crate system is that you wrap it like a birthday present in a pond liner. And then that can be a great underground use storage system. Here, where it doesn't freeze so much, you'd probably want to go with various products that can be either just above ground cisterns or partially buried to get below the frost line. You know, as you get up into the mountains, there will be that challenge, and you don't necessarily want to have your tank freeze. If it's full of water, it can handle it, but there is that little connection between the tank and the line that can be a narrow diameter, and that can freeze. So burying the tank below the frost line often makes sense. If the tank is against a house, it might not be necessary, however, so it could be overkill even around here in some of the higher elevations to do very much partially burying. But those tanks are typically plastic that can be both buried and above ground. But some people use culverts and stick them into wet concrete. That can leak. So what is often used is a little, basically a bladder inside that structure, like a big water balloon in there that can work as a tank system.
So if people are trying to get some help on designing these things? Should they contact their local permaculture guild? Should they contact...
They can contact me at this point. I'm traveling from here to Los Angeles and promoting my book, Harvest the Rain, and it's harvesttherain.com. If you say you heard me on your show, I could definitely direct them to various links depending on what they're looking for.
Uh-huh.
One place to get gray water components, and there is an important thing to know, it's in Oakland. I wanted to mention cleanwatercomponents.com has some sort of alternative parts that are helpful with the gray water system.
And again, it's just important because these things are really hard to find, and a lot of people don't have the means to go out to their hardware store and build something. I know some people who do have that ability, mm-hmm. but you know, a lot of people want something that's kind of partially at least constructed.
Right.
I think that it's becoming more prevalent. People are actually, who have been ordering the parts from Australia and Germany, are now starting to get innovative and looking to design their own systems locally.
Oh, yes. There's lots of sort of turnkey systems you can buy that have the tank, have the pump, have the filter, and everything ready to go.
Yeah.
And I can hook people up with that, too.
In many countries, water harvest is something they do every day and have been doing for hundreds of years. Everybody has a rainwater catchment system. It's normal, even if they live well below the poverty line.
Right, right. There's a story in my book where the guy explains that his filtration system for the water we just drank was nothing but a pantyhose. That was very interesting, and it tasted great. And he's from a very civilized part of the world, New Zealand. So what would it look like in the long haul, I think, is we'd have a society that was much more resilient to catastrophe, earthquake. You can design systems so that you can have, because you've designed it correctly with enough give, that in, say, most earthquakes, your water system might be available rather than being cut off. You'll have much more edible food production. In New Mexico, 1 in 4 barrels of oil or sort of units of carbon is used simply to move water.
Mm-hmm.
And so water is very heavy, and it does take a lot of either coal or nuclear or something to move it to you. So that's something to consider as well. So I think we'd end up with a happier community as well if we are having people really considering their watersheds as these special places that need to be protected. We'd be in a much more healthier space as a society as well, because I think if people start caring for the earth, they can care for each other on a pretty deep level as well. And permaculture isn't just about caring for the earth. The second ethic is care for people, because it understands if people's basic needs aren't met, they're going to leave junk around just to kind of get to the next place where they can get some more food or whatever it is. And so there's a lot of sympathy to that and a lot of understanding that people are only people, and that don't expect too much of them right away. What we want is to start now, start small, and build every year. Build gradually toward this permacultural, sustainable society every year and always improve, but we're not going to get there overnight.
One of the beautiful things about permaculture and about rainwater harvest and farming and soil care is the sense of community. When you are making water that you're sharing, or when you are sharing seed to aid in your permaculture, or when you're building soil, or when you're working in a community, you're building community.
Right. So another thing that when we look to the vision, and this points to your previous question in terms of the politics, is it is going to mean a lot more of us showing up at different meetings online with petitions and making our voices heard. That is going to have to happen, because as much as there's this obvious thing that we have to do, become more sustainable in our local environments, there's also forces that are very large, business forces, political forces, that have their stake in the status quo. For all of you activists out there, water is a great issue. And what's great about it too is that it actually brings people together on the local level. It doesn't matter what your political persuasion is. Protecting your watershed is important for everyone. So it's a good way of bringing people together as well.
Thank you very much for joining us, and thank the Campus Center for Appropriate Technology for hosting Nate Downey while he's been here with us. They're a wonderful group and organization. Do check them out. Can you leave us with your contact information for folks who want to learn more?
Thank you, Rain. The best way to reach me is harvesttherain.com, also sfpermaculture.com, but we'll just stick with harvesttherain.com, and you can get me from there.
Nate Downey is the author of Harvest the Rain. It's a great book to give you a sense of what you can do to accumulate water and improve water quality and get involved with your soil. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been the Eco News Report, and my name is Raina Nanayel. I've been your host for the past half hour. I was speaking with Nate Downey. He's the author of Harvest the Rain. We were talking about water conservation issues. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again at the KHSU website under archive programs at khsu.org. The EcoNews Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Thank you to our engineer, Fred McLaughlin. Please join us again next Thursday at 1:30 p.m. here on KHSU for the EcoNews Report.